You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In The Last Empire, the final days of the Soviet Union, Serhiy Plokhiy makes the case that Ukraine played a pivotal role in the breakup of the Soviet Union, and he draws parallels between the relationship between Russia and Ukraine in 1991 and Russian President Vladimir Putin's power grabs in Ukraine today. Mr. Plokhiy is the Mykhailo Hrushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History and Director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. His book is published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased that has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
And you see a lot of parallels in what's happening today between Ukraine and Russia and what happened in 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union. Does what's happening now surprise you?
Well, it does, in a sense, because I believed that the final chapter of the existence of the Soviet Union was written back then in 1991. And when I look now at what is happening in Ukraine, around Ukraine, in Eastern Europe in general, I kind of changed my mind, and I think that the story of the disintegration of the Soviet Union is not over yet, and what we witness now is possibly its last chapter.
So it has, what's happening now has its roots in the struggle between them when they were republics of the USSR?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The Soviet Union fell after the Ukrainian referendum on December 1st of 1991. And the reason for that was that if Yeltsin said, if Ukraine is not signing Union Treaty, Russia would not sign as well. So what is happening today, we heard news last week coming from Kazakhstan about creation of new economic union, which includes Belarus, Kazakhstan, Russia, but not Ukraine. This is actually the same group without Ukraine that was key back in December of 1991 for the continuing existence or death of the Soviet Union.
Well, when previous president decided not to join the EU or to move in that direction, wasn't there a suggestion that he was looking to join this other group?
Well, absolutely. The protests on Maidan, the main square in Kyiv, started in November of 2013 when news reached people in Kyiv that the government decided not to sign association agreement with European Union. And many believed at that time that the main reason for that was lobbying on the part of Russia, which at that time offered economically struggling Ukraine a bailout package of $15 billion. So from the very beginning, from the end of the last year, what was happening in Kyiv in Ukraine had this context, geopolitical, very rich geopolitical context.
Hasn't Vladimir Putin questioned the legality of Ukraine's secession from the Soviet Union in 1991?
Well, this is exactly what happens according to Mustafa Jamilev, the leader of Crimean Tatars, who discussed the situation with Vladimir Putin at the time when Russian troops were moving into the Crimea.
Now, the Tatars were opposed Crimea joining Russia.
Yes, yes. And basically, this is their official position until now, until today. And apparently, in the telephone conversation between Mr. Putin and Mustafa Jamilev, the Russian president questioned the legality of Ukrainian succession.
But many people also argue that this is really a response to the expansion of NATO and Western Europe into Eastern Europe, the part of Europe that was under the Soviet sphere of influence ever since World War II. And so the United States and Europe were warned that this could lead to a negative response, and it has.
Well, I don't agree with this interpretation of events. And the reason for that is that what triggered the current crisis was the possibility of Ukraine not joining NATO, not joining European Union.
As Poland and
the
Czech Republic and so many others have.
But signing an association agreement, which actually, from the point of view of Kyiv, was ideal situation that they would be still between East and West playing the game that they were playing for 20 years. So it's not West moving toward Ukraine, but it's an attempt of Russia to build an economic, political, and military union that would deal on par with Europe and with China, that is the cause of the current crisis.
What about ethnic tensions, which we're seeing in Ukraine now? The East and Crimea, more ethnically Russian than the rest of the country. Has Russia always been able to exploit that in Ukraine?
Well, certainly Russia is there talking about Crimea and Donbass starting with probably August of 1991, immediately after the coup, something that I describe in my book. But in reality, until today, there was no real tensions. Even the Russian annexation of the Crimea, they were not able to come up with any... There is pretext, but there is no proof that Russians or Russian language or Russian culture were ever mistreated in Ukraine and in the Crimea in particular.
Well, how did these areas vote in 1991 when the issue of Ukrainian independence came up? Did they vote for independence?
Well, in Donbass, the arena of today's conflicts and sometimes bloody conflicts, the vote for independence was over 70%. In the Crimea, the vote was 54% in favor of independence, and in Sevastopol, the base of the Soviet Black Sea Fleet, the vote was even higher, 57%. So that's the reason, because there was the majority vote for independence, that those areas joined independent Ukraine. It would be different if in the Crimea they wouldn't get 50%, let's say.
There was a piece in today's New York Times about dissatisfaction in areas like Luhansk over the high unemployment rate and the deterioration of the infrastructure in the 23 years since the end of the Soviet Union and since independence.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donbass is the most, in economic terms, depressed region of Ukraine. So it's a rust belt, which whatever sovereignty, whatever country has sovereignty over the region, unless there are really major financial investment in the area, that region will be suffering. And back in 1991, the hope of people who voted for independence was that Ukraine, the independence per se, would solve those problems. It didn't. And the dissatisfaction is certainly very high there. It is high also in other areas.
Well, is the assumption in these areas that Russia is going to help them out? Because the breakaway republics in Georgia are suffering economically, despite the fact that there was a promise of aid there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there is this is hope on the part of the population, especially the retirees, because they look at the level of the pensions paid in Russia and they're significantly higher than they're in Ukraine. What is forgotten, of course, is that with the higher pensions come higher prices. So the Russia is attractive, economically is attractive for part of the Ukrainian population. But again, the question is whether Russia is prepared to make this huge investments in Donbass. It is not clear. Certainly, the annexation of the Crimea now adds difficulties to Russian economy and pokes one more hole in the Russian budget.
My guest is Serhiy Plokhy. His book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. Was there ever a discussion about the boundaries of the Ukraine when it became independent? Did Yeltsin ever try to hold on to parts of Ukraine when he was the Russian president and the Soviet Union was dissolving?
Well, in 1990, Yeltsin went to Ukraine and signed an agreement recognizing Ukrainian borders, and Ukrainian officials recognized the borders of the Russian Federation. But then it changed immediately after the coup in Moscow, in late August of 1991. What happened back then was that Yeltsin successfully outmaneuvered Gorbachev, and really, Russia was taking over the Soviet Union, was taking the center over. And at that time, Yeltsin and people around him started to worry about Russians and other republics and borders in general. So in late August of 1991, we have the first statement on the part of the spokesman for Mr. Yeltsin, saying that if Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and other republics leave the Soviet Union, Russia will have the right to raise question of the borders. It didn't work at that time. Republics revolted. United States of America, that was a major player at that time in the events, didn't want that to happen as well. And then in 1994, already during the presidency of Bill Clinton, an agreement was reached between Russia and Ukraine. Part of that agreement was Ukraine shipping its nuclear arms to Russia in exchange for the recognition of its territorial sovereignty. It was in 1994.
So it was 3 years after independence that it finally was assuring itself that it was safe.
Yes, yes. So it wasn't just the Belovezhye agreements in Belarus. It wasn't just the official resignation of Gorbachev, but this process really lasted into 1994.
Well, Russia has had some economic problems because it's pretty much a petroleum state with little else going for it. But Ukraine has fared a lot worse. Why?
Well, one of the reasons is that, like Russia, Ukraine really didn't undergo the kind of reforms that, let's say, Poland or other East European countries went through. And if Russia has oil and gas to deal and to fund its infrastructure without this really comprehensive reform, Ukraine doesn't have that kind of natural resources.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to deal with the story as we have been told it and have been told in this country, that Ronald Reagan really set this whole thing in motion, and George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, we remember, called the fall of the Soviet Union on December 25th, 1991, a victory for democracy. He said, by the grace of God, America won the Cold War. Then in his State of the Union address following that, he said the Cold War didn't end, it was won. We'll find out why that sounds so different from the story that you're telling us. My guest is Serhii Plokhii. He is the Mykhailo Rushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History and Director of Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. And his book is The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. It's published by Basic Books. Stay with us. My guest is Serhii Plokhii, Serhii Plokhii. His book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, published by Basic Books. Your book challenges the interpretation that the United States' policies had significant influence on what was going on inside the Soviet Union to cause it to collapse. What kind of new evidence do you have that this is not the case?
Well, as you said before, administration of George H.W. Bush many times tried to present the fall of the Soviet Union, the disintegration of the USSR, as a sign of American victory in the Cold War.
And then they credit Ronald Reagan, largely his policies, with leading to that.
Right, right. And what I'm saying is that the dismemberment or partitioning of the Soviet Union was never American goal in the Cold War. And more than that, my work with the recently declassified documents in George H.W. Bush Library and Museum show that almost until the very end, until late November of 1991, the U.S. and administration and White House were doing almost everything in their power to prolong the life of the Soviet Union.
Why would they want that?
To keep Gorbachev in power as long as possible. Well, the reasons, there were some very good reasons for doing that. One of them was personal good relations between Bush and Gorbachev, so we can't really discount that. Another was that after the first Gulf War, the Soviet Union really became a junior partner of the United States on the international arena, cooperating with the U.S. on a number of international issues, from Africa to Middle East. There was a Middle East conference that started the peace process there. Again, without the Soviet cooperation, it would be impossible. So they didn't want to lose that kind of ally. If Gorbachev would be gone, they didn't know what would happen.
How has the U.S. triumphalist narrative influenced perceptions of why and how the Soviet Union fell? I understand its impact on this country, but what about the rest of the world, especially the former Soviet Union. Have they also bought into it?
Well, absolutely. In Russia, there are some very influential today conspiracy theories that say that the Soviet Union disintegrated and fell apart because of the actions of the CIA, because of so-called Harvard Project. So apparently there is a group of people who got together in one room, decided how to do that, and this is on main channels. So it's another side of the same coin that the United States played so important role in the disintegration of the USSR. It didn't. The U.S. wanted the USSR to go maybe indefinitely.
Well, you argue that the main reason the Soviet Union fell apart was because of the tensions between its two largest republics, Russia and Ukraine. Well, first, can we get a little history of Ukraine and Russia? Don't Russians see Ukraine as actually the fountainhead of much of Russian culture?
Well, certainly Russian historical narrative starts in Kyiv, which happened to be, as we know today, capital of Ukraine, and this is also the beginning of Ukrainian history. So for a long period of time, both nations used, up until 19th century, maybe one and the same historical narrative, beginning in Kyiv and then going through the Mongol invasion and so on and so forth. But then came 19th century, the spring of nations, the beginning of the national movements, and that's when people started to pay attention to languages. That's the time when the modern national identity started to form. And it is around that time that also the political movements in Russia and Ukraine develop in a very different way.
Well, how different is Ukrainian from Russian as a language? Are they just dialects of each other?
They're different languages. They were considered by Russian Imperial Academy of Sciences to be the same language up until the revolution of 1905. And then the decision was made by the Academy of Sciences that they are different languages. And for my friends, because I grew up in the environment where both Russian and Ukrainian was used, I didn't know until I was 6 years old that actually there were two languages around me. So for
you
me,
you could just make a sentence that would mix up the two languages.
Absolutely, good part of Ukraine speaks in mixing, creating some kind of a language salad out of those two languages, and then throwing English as well. So, but when I talk to my Russian friends who never were exposed to the Ukrainian, or Ukrainians from here, from the United States, who didn't study Russian, I see that they switch to English, or I have to serve as an interpreter. Again, something that I still can't comprehend, but that's what I see.
The communist leader of Ukraine at the time of the independence vote was Leonid Kravchuk. What was he like as a leader?
Well, he was really a very shrewd politician. So someone who believe outsmarted both Gorbachev and Yeltsin in the way how he conducted negotiations close to the end of the Soviet Union in December of 1991. And I was lucky enough to interview Mr. Kravchuk, and I asked him why, after Ukraine declared independence, why you went to Belarus and signed with Yeltsin and then later with others agreement on the creation of the Commonwealth. And he said that I knew from the very beginning that it is not enough to declare independence. You need this independence to be recognized by Russia, and that was the only way how I could achieve that goal.
And what kind of state did he envision?
Well,
not a Western-style democracy.
Well, he certainly, and all of them, including all the party leadership at that time, they saw that the old system didn't work. So they were open to the ideas of democratic change. After all, they were democratically elected to the parliament, and then democratically elected was Kravchuk to his presidency. But there were limits, they believed, on how far they would be prepared to go there. And Kravchuk is an embodiment of this old party nomenclatura, old party class. So there is, they embraced one part of Western model, but then were really very reluctant to go all the way.
But then there's the whole economic issue. These are countries where entrepreneurship could get you thrown into jail, and now suddenly it's being encouraged. Was there a, total commitment to capitalism?
Well, no, and especially when it comes to sale of land and turning land and agriculture in general, putting it on the market grounds. So there was a very strong opposition from the so-called collective farms lobby, and they were really very, very influential in the parliament. And the same was with the large enterprises. So it took first Russia actually started privatization process, and only then Ukraine joined in.
The first President Bush visited Kyiv, gave a speech in August 1991. What did he say?
Well, that speech became famous and notorious as Chicken Kyiv speech.
That's what William Safire called it.
Exactly. And what President Bush was trying to say there was really very difficult sell in Ukraine or other republics. He was saying that the Baltic states had the right to leave the Soviet Union, but the rest of the republics would better stay together, and that was for their benefit. So many believe that he was doing President Gorbachev's bidding in Ukraine. So it didn't sit well with many in Ukraine, and then many also in this country. That's the phrase was coined here in the U.S., not in Kyiv.
So the main critics were probably members of his own party.
Absolutely. There was criticism coming from the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and there was criticism coming from mobilized East European communities and lobby here in the U.S., from Baltic states, Poland, Ukraine, Armenia. So there was a lot of pressure coming from within the Republican Party. But by 91, you see already future President Bill Clinton there criticizing indices of policy of Bush. And so pressure was coming from that side as well.
My guest is Serhiy Plokhiy. His book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that the collapse wasn't caused by the economic decline and the abandonment of communist ideals, but rather I'm quoting, the imperial foundations, multi-ethnic composition, and pseudo-federal structure of the Soviet state. We've seen this play out in Chechnya, Georgia, now in Ukraine. Why were these factors overlooked by the United States in 1991?
No one looked at the Soviet Union back then as a state that had a lot of elements of empire, still the old Russian empire. Neither Gorbachev nor Bush, no one believed that Gorbachev was ruling over empire. The belief was that the national question, to a degree that existed in the old Russian Empire and in the early Soviet Union, was resolved, and it was resolved successfully. And what the collapse of the Soviet Union showed to me, I'm saying in the book that whether the Soviet Union was an empire or wasn't an empire, the debate is still going on, but it died the death of an empire, falling along the lines drawn by the ethnographers of the 19th century who were studying language and culture. So from that point of view, the collapse of the USSR, it's the collapse of the last great European empire.
Which you call a pseudo-federal state.
Yes.
Was the United States nervous that the dissolution of the Soviet Union would be chaotic, might spark massive territorial ethnic disputes, with a lot of people dying, as we've seen in other situations like the partition of India into India and Pakistan?
Yes, absolutely. I mentioned before some of the reasons why Bush administration wanted the Soviet Union go, or the process of disintegration be slowed up. The main reason was really the threat that what was happening in the Soviet Union would turn into Yugoslavia's nukes, as they were calling it, so that there would be one republic fighting another, like it is happening today between Russia and Ukraine, with Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus still having nuclear arsenals and having nuclear arms. So that was really a major concern, and my belief is that while the Bush administration maybe misrepresented its role in the demise of the Soviet Union, the way how it played its cards in terms of the peaceful dissolution of the Soviet Union, there is a lot that we can learn today from that experience.
You focus on a five-month period of time from late July to late December 1991, which began with a meeting between President Bush and Gorbachev in Moscow.
Yes, this was
seen as the first post-Cold War summit.
Yes, exactly, which certainly goes against the narrative saying that it is the resignation of Gorbachev that ends the Cold War. The Cold War was declared to be finished, not won, finished, completed already in 1990, and then 1991 was the first post-Cold War summit. Very, very interesting event in itself. And a major step toward the disarmament. So for the first time, the agreement was signed where they were talking not just about the limiting arsenals, but actually cutting those arsenals. And that was another reason why Bush didn't want Gorbachev to disappear from the international arena. He could talk to him. He could reach agreements like the one that was reached in August of 91, July of 91.
Even though there was a lot of posturing, the Soviets were still being painted as the United States' arch enemies. Was it clear at that summit that things were coming apart in the USSR?
It was. It was clear. So behind this image of two superpowers, equal partners talking to each other, there was already crumbling Soviet economy. And you can see that in the information that is sent back by correspondents. You can see that from major TV stations being there. They're talking not only about the summit, they're talking also about a sorry state of ordinary Russians in Moscow and all over the Soviet Union.
Although Russia did have resources, especially oil and coal and other minerals. Ukraine has some coal, but what else does it have going for it?
It has some coal and it has some oil deposits. But other than that, the main real resource in the country is soil. Is black soil. Apparently one of the best in Europe and in the world. And that's the foundation of the Ukrainian agriculture.
But Ukraine has suffered serious economic problems. Is that because of the corruption in the government or simply because agriculture wasn't enough to keep it going?
Well, you're right on both counts. But what I would add also is that from the very beginning, the Ukrainian independence was a compromise between the party elites represented by Kravchuk and by National Democrats who were active in western part of Ukraine, but also in major industrial cities like city of Kharkiv, for example. And that was an easy compromise, which really didn't allow the proponents of radical reforms to push them fast enough and to follow the Polish way and the Polish model.
Well, the oligarchs in Ukraine seem to have more political clout than they do in Russia, partly because Yeltsin throws you in jail if you say the wrong thing. Did that whole development of the oligarchs follow the Russian model, where people in good positions wound up becoming very rich and other people who might have been just as competent didn't get anything?
Absolutely. The story of privatization in Ukraine is as complex, as dramatic, tragic, and bloody as it was in Russia, with the exception that there was fewer assets to privatize and also to fight for. Oil and gas was not there to start with. Also, what happened in Russia with Mr. Putin coming to power is that he was able to put Russian oligarchs under the control of the state. What we see in Ukraine is that oligarchs are still quite independent forces, in not only in economic terms, but also in political terms.
And able to muster forces of their own, as we saw in eastern Ukraine, where the chocolate king wound up getting his miners or his workers to fight against this, what may very well be an invading Russian army?
Well, what we see now is one of the oligarchs, Mr. Kolomoisky, in the city of Dnipropetrovsk, is being very pro-Ukrainian, organizes his basically private militia forces. Another oligarch in Donetsk area, Mr. Akhmetov, eventually was playing game with the separatists and eventually was forced to leave the region. New president of Ukraine, Mr. Petro Poroshenko, as you say, a chocolate king, he is a small oligarch compared to these big guys like Akhmetov and Kolomoisky. And what I was really very happy to hear from him, that he is saying that within the next few months he is selling his assets. Overall, he is worth apparently between $1 and $1.5 billion. And that will be it for him as an oligarch, as a businessman. So there is hope on that side.
Well, how do you see all of this playing out for Ukraine? Is Crimea lost to Ukraine for good? Do you think that a number of the eastern areas might very well wind up rejoining Russia? Or is there a possibility of some kind of a diplomatic solution to this?
I hope there is a possibility of diplomatic solution, and I hope that after June the 7th, when new Ukrainian president will become officially, will assume the office, that diplomatic track will be resumed. In terms of eastern Ukraine, and in particular Donbas, my understanding is that there are two choices for the region. I don't know which way it will go, but one, it goes back to Ukraine. Another one, it becomes another Transnistria or Ossetia, this unrecognized enclave. Because my understanding is that Russian economy is already in trouble now. Sanctions is part of that, but that started before the sanctions. So they can't take on one more region, which is really a rust belt, as I told before, that which needs a lot of investment. So I don't see that area joining Russia anytime soon. Regarding the Crimea, it's a little bit different situation. My understanding is that the key thing why Crimea, first of all, was turned and given to Ukraine in 1954 were the matters of geography. Crimea is not an island. It is a peninsula. So all supplies to that peninsula come from mainland that happened to be Ukraine. And what happened today didn't really change the geography. The Russian government is trying now to change the geography, talking about building a bridge from Russian territory to the Crimea that can bring in new factor economically and otherwise into the story of the Crimea. But as long as geography remains as it is, and if Ukraine succeeds as a reform-oriented pro-European state, I think sooner or later there will be found some diplomatic solution for the Crimean problem.
Serhiy Plokhiy, Mykhailo Horoshevsky, too many difficult names here, professor of Ukrainian history and director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. His book, The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union, it's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.